And so, as Bob said already, this will be a continuation of the previous talk. And the first thing I want to talk about is our experiment, which has been performed at the University of British Columbia. And for this experiment, Bill and I, we changed from theorists to experimentalists. And we found fantastic people in the civil engineering department to collaborate with us on this project. There's Professor Greg Lawrence and Dr. Ted Tedford. And Matt Penrice is a student, an undergraduate student who did the honor thesis on this project. And also initially there was Maurizio Ricard involved, but unfortunately he had to leave because he was only there for a short time at the experiments. So the first thing, so analog gravity models are very nice, but will they really work? So in order to answer this question, I will talk you through this experiment, and hopefully if time permits at the end, I have a few slides on can we actually the concepts developed in this analog gravity program, can we extend them to mimic full quantum gravity simulations? Now, let's start right away. So if you remember, Bill was talking about the original paper was based on sound waves. And of course, there's a problem. If you speed up the fluid flow to sound waves, to the speed of sound waves, you very likely get into a turbulent regime. You will form shock waves in the system. And of course, all this linearization process on which the analogy was derived breaks down. The validity of this analogy, analog gravity program breaks down. So these are not good analog gravity models to set up in the experiments. Instead, what we are focusing on, our experiment, was done for surface waves on shallow water flows. So why are there so nice analog gravity models? So what you want to do here, I wrote down the effective line element as it arises. So you have an if you look at the excitations on the free surface, the gravity waves in the system, they are governed by an effective metric tensor. And this effective metric tensor, if you see here, what's entering is C is the propagation speed of the surface waves, V is the background flow. So if you want to set up analog black hole horizons, black hole or white hole horizons, you need to find the way to actually that the background flow exceeds the propagation speed. So one system where this naturally very easily is obtained are surface waves, as I said. The reason is very simple. If you look at the background flow, for example, and you insert an obstacle in the flow, so you have varying depths in the flow height, so you have a flow with a varying depth, then you see that the velocity scales like 1 over the, due to the conservation of mass, the velocity scales like 1 over h. So if the flow gets shallower, the background flow speeds up. At the same time, the propagation speed of the surface waves is proportional to h, the depth of the flow. So if the flow gets shallower, those become slower. At the same time, the background velocity speeds up. So easily you can exceed, you have regions, what we call critical regions, where the propagations cannot counterpropagate to the flow. We call them the trapped regions. And the moment where those two are equal, we call them the effective horizons. Now, the scientific goal was to set up analog black and white hole horizon, and we want to detect the stimulated conversion to positive and negative waves whose relative amplitudes obey Hawking's law equation. So why are we focusing on the white hole horizon? And that is because it's easier we stimulate the system, and it's easier to stimulate the system in the right way on the white hole horizon. But of course, the physics at the white hole horizon, since the white hole horizon is just a time reversal of the black hole, the physics is same, and the Hawking's formula for black hole radiation also applies to the white hole horizon. Now, so here is, yes?
What is the variation of the Reynolds number with H?
So we have a very, okay, so what we are assuming, we haven't checked that, we're assuming that we have no viscosity in the system, so we have no turbulence. We try to set up a laminar flow. The way we checked it, actually, we put little particles into the flow, and we could the particle stream, we would take a PIV measurements, and we could see if really you have little eddies forming or if you really have a laminar flow. And the obstacle was designed just to avoid these turbulences. So we would not take any consideration of Reynolds number and so forth into account. We would work in the laminar regime. Well, actually, so let me put it this way. We were neglecting any effects like that. We had an analogy which was derived under the assumption that the Reynolds numbers don't play a role. And later on, basically, we could see that this governs the physics very well.
What was the Reynolds number?
In experiment, what is the Reynolds number?
Actually, I don't know. Bill, do you know what the Reynolds number of water?
It depends on the geometry. Yeah,
right, but
the
velocities in the system were about 0.7 meters per second.
Why do you want to know?
Because I want to know whether it's laminar or turbulent. Well, I want to know what kind of flow you have.
We measured it and showed it was laminar.
I know, I just want to know what the
measurements are much more important than theory.
Okay.
It's not a question of theory, it's just trying to understand.
Critical comments have been made, let's go on.
Okay, so let me quickly talk you through this. So here you see a setup. This is our setup. It's in the civil engineering department. That's usually a flume used for undergraduate students to learn how to measure the height and the flow velocity of an open channel flow. Now, for one year, the students couldn't do any experiments on this. Instead, we were using this for our black hole experiments. And what you see here, this is the water reservoir. The water gets pumped here through, comes in, and the inlet at the back. There are some horse mesh and so on to take out turbulence. It comes in, it flows over the obstacle, goes through, and of course it's a stationary system, so time independent. So there will be, it settles at a constant height. And here at the end of this is our obstacle, so that we can modify the flow depths. And the obstacle is designed, as I said, such that there is no turbulence in the system. And at the end of the channel, we had a wave generator which we used to stimulate the system. And to send in, as we will see here, there's an analog white hole horizon. I explain this on the next slide. To send in surface waves. So this is our setup. Now, how does it work? Here is a snapshot. This is an old obstacle. And what you can see here, these are the three different regions. On this is the water is going, is indicated by the blue lines. So when the water comes over the obstacle, the water speeds up. And here, the dotted arrows are for the surface waves. And you can see that in this region here, from the downstream of the flow, the background the surface waves propagate faster, so it can propagate in both directions, till they hit this one point, the surface here, where they are actually equal. The surface wave speed equals the background speed, which we call effective white hole horizon. Nothing can enter, so waves which come downstream get blocked on this horizon. Now, inside, of course, here, we say it's a critical region where the background flow is larger than this perturbation on the surface. So nothing can counterpropagate. Everything goes downstream. This is our inside of our black hole. And on this side here, if you come from upstream, this is the point, basically, you can propagate in both directions here and till you hit the black hole horizon, and everything goes inside. So this is our critical region, and these are our subcritical regions. Now, let us have a look at let us have a look at an old experiment. This is one of the first setups we did. Later on, we replaced the wave generator with something very different. The waves you would actually generate in experiments are about 1 millimeter amplitude. You see here we send surface waves, long wavelengths, into the analog white hole horizon. So the waves propagate upstream till they finally hit the white hole horizon. And as you can see, nothing is propagating through. And the question, what happens? What happens exactly here? And can I describe that by with the Hawking radiation, the black hole evaporation process. Now, in order to do that, we need to, yes?
Is the green fluorescein dye or something?
So this is initially, this is green dye. It would fluorescence in the pink. However, this is an old setup where we used visible light to create the light sheet. So later on, we used the laser light, and we would have a different dye. But this is green dye, and it would actually be fluorescent in the pink light. It is fluorescing, but what you see here, the green, this is just the color of the dye, but if you then shine light on it, it would, of course, peak in a different color. So this is our setup, and what we want to observe are the excitations on the surface. In order to do that, we need to understand the physics of that. So Bill already introduced to that. So what are the free excitations on the surface? So if we have long wavelengths, and one wavelength means roughly more than 10 times the depth of the water, you have shallow water wave. And if you have wavelengths comparable to the depths of the water, you're in the deep water regime. And if you go to smaller wavelengths, then you're in the capillary regime. So surface waves are circular waves. They're neither longitudinal or transverse. they're circular waves, and depending if they're shallow water waves or deep water waves, they see or they see not the bottom of the tank. Now, in the shallow water regime, all the propagation, so the long wavelengths in the system, they propagate roughly with the same propagation speed. And that is the regime where we can establish the analogy. The deep water wave, actually, they have a velocity which is momentum dependent, which is dependent on the wavelengths of the system. Now, if you look at the possible excitations here, so you see, in our case, you will always say this branch here would be, you look at a water at rest, there's no background velocity. The possible excitations are you have the wave number versus the frequency. And if you now, for example, put a wave generator on, it says, you know, I'm generating with a certain frequency. This, the dispersion relation gives me the wavelengths which I'm generating. And then you can have an up and a downstream moving mode. Now, this situation changes when you have a background flow. There will be an asymmetry of the downstream moving and the upstream moving modes. The downstream moving mode will be very fast, and the upstream moving modes will be very slow. So, and when you stimulate them, of course, then you have more possible solutions. So I plotted here the dispersion relations, the possible dispersion relation at the different heights in our flume. Now, how well can we, so how do we observe this? How do we observe these surface waves? What is our observable in our system? So what we take, we have our water here, we put some dye in there. It's rhodamine type beta dye. And we have a laser light sheet, we have a power lens, so it's a two-dimensional light sheet hitting the free surface. And here, this thin line here is our observable. It contains everything, the wavelengths, the frequency, and the amplitudes of the waves. Now, of course, remember, this is a stationary system, so everything we're interested in happens at one particular frequency band. Now, what we can do, we can take for our experiment what we took for every setup. We would take 2,000 images, 20 frames a second, 2,000 images, so we recorded for 100 seconds. And we would read out in any one of these pictures, we take pictures, and then we read in each one, we would read out this line, and we can stick them together to a wave characteristic, and we can Fourier transform it. And what you see here is the result if you just have a stationary flow, a uniform depth. And what you see here, these are the branches of the dispersion relation, the upstream moving one and the downstream moving one. And this red and black line, which are hard to see, that indicate basically the theoretical prediction. So we very well have a very good grasp on the excitations on this system. Now, what we do is, as I said, we need to stimulate the system. We want to send in big signals so that what's coming out is also big, is detectable. Now, what we are sending in, when I say big, I'm talking about something in the order of millimeters. These are the waves we're sending in. This is at the end of our channel. You can hardly see it. Here we have a mesh grid. This is our wave generator. And what we generate are various frequencies, starting from 0.02 Hertz up to 1 Hertz. And we stimulate the system with these ingoing frequencies. And we would take one frequency at a time, record 2,000 pictures, change the setting, use a different driving frequency, and repeat it. So we stimulate the system at all of these frequencies. In some sense, we simulate a quantum vacuum. Now, this is what we get by taking off the free surface and stacking each line, each free surface in its picture gives me the free surface at an instant of time. So I have here space and here time, and I can stack together all the various wave characteristics. That's what we record, and this is what we use to perform our data analysis. Now, what you can see already, if you look at these things, for example, the waves come in, and you see that here there's something different. This is where already roughly you can see this is a white hole horizon. As you also see, some of the wave energy is tunneling through. What it means is exponentially dying out, tunneled through the critical region. That is, of course, expected. But this is why also we modified our obstacles such that there was a longer top flat part to extend the critical region, the width of the critical region. Now, what do we really want to see? So I will show you everything on one particular example, which is the ingoing frequency 0.18 Hertz. And we repeat the data analysis for each one of these wave characteristics. So what are we really looking for? We want to see the Hawking effect. So what is the Hawking effect really? What are we looking for? So as Bill pointed out before, the Hawking, it's a very naive picture, but I just want to emphasize this again. So if you look at nearby a black hole horizon, you see that you have all these vacuum fluctuations. And according to Hawking, these particle-antiparticle pairs are getting separated, there is a positive norm particle which gets emitted away from the black hole, and there's a negative norm particle which gets absorbed of the black hole, falls into the black hole, and effectively reducing the energy of the black hole. So the energy of this process comes from the black hole. Now, what we want to see is basically what Hawking also predicts. He said the ratio of how much falls into the black hole and how much gets emitted away, that is determined with e to the minus omega divided, omega is the frequency of the particular mode, divided by the surface gravity. So this is the law. It tells you how much gets sent away and how much gets observed. That is the Hawking law, and that's what we want to see. Of course, Hawking also said that if you look at this, you can write it as this already has some Boltzmann-like statistics, right? And I can, of course, equivalence that to something h bar omega over kBT, and this T here will be the Hawking temperature. But this is not what we are going to do. We directly want to measure those two things. So we want to see the wave which comes in, if it gets converted to a pair of waves, and if this, if I calculate the norm for those, if they actually obey this relation. Here is our result. So we remember we had this wave characteristic at a particular 0.185 Hertz frequency. And what we do a double Fourier transform analysis. And what we see actually is what happens, we're interested only what happens in this particular frequency band. This is the ingoing frequency. This we send in a long wavelength, which we're sending in here. And what you can see already, there are two peaks, two other wavelengths, actually outgoing wavelengths in this case. And these are the Hawking pair, the pair creation at this point. So how we can see this, we can also look at our dispersion relation, the upstream moving mode. And we see this is sending in, and it gets converted to those two coming out. Now, what we can do is we can just filter this out, get rid of the rest of it. You can see already here the noise level is very low in the neighbor bands. We can do an inverse Fourier transform again, only leaving in this one frequency band. And what you see here is a superposition, basically, of this positive and negative frequency mode. We also filtered out this one, the ingoing. We only have those two left. I can also, in order to demonstrate better what's going on, take out, for example, this part, only leave this in, which is a negative norm partner, or I can only leave that out, that's a positive norm partner. Now, what I'm expecting here, and that's not so clear to see, is when the wave comes in, the ingoing wave comes, gets blocked at the effective white hole horizon. What's happening there is it gets converted to this pair of waves. The one of it on the dispersion relation has, both of them has an outgoing group velocity. However, one has an ingoing phase velocity and the other one an outgoing phase velocity. And what you see here are this phase velocity. So this is a mode coming out, but it has a phase velocity pointing inward. This is a mode, is a negative norm, has a phase velocity going this way. The difference, if you want to see here, you can see what is the difference between phase and group velocity. You can see, for example, an old experiment, we send in a burst of waves, then we stop, and you can see all of these waves have an ingoing phase velocity, but its group velocity is outgoing. Now, that's not good enough. That just shows that there is a pair of waves created. But how can we go from this pair of waves, how can we go to Hawking's law? Now, what we can do, actually, we can look at these amplitudes. Because according to the black hole evaporation process, it matters how much gets converted to the positive and negative norm partner. So what I'm plotting here is the amplitude over wavelengths, and I can show in each one of these frequency bands, I'm looking at the 0.42, the 0.19, and the 0.02. And you can see already that they differ how much gets converted to this part and how much gets converted to that part. And this dashed red line is an indication for the noise. So of course, we need, in order, usually Hawking process is evaluated infinitely far away from the black hole. Now, we don't have this luxury because what's coming out are actually deep water waves. And that is model dependent. What shouldn't be model dependent, what the ratio is of which they're emitted. Now, we are looking at, in order to go from this, we need to look at a conserved quantity, which is the norm, which is approximately given by this formula. So there's the amplitude, the frequency, and the wavelengths in a different coordinate system. And what you can do, you basically integrate out the amplitudes here. And you say, actually, the total norm is conserved. And with this, you can calculate, you can check if, in fact, it is Boltzmann-like. And you can do this for every one of these frequencies. And what you can calculate this ratio, beta squared over alpha squared, and take the log of it, you get all these points. And of course, or as expected, or luckily, they're lying on a straight line. So the question now, the last question we have to answer, so it is Boltzmann-like, it is somewhere, but the question is this slope related to the effective white hole horizon?
Are there error bars?
No, not yet. We're working on it. We're working on it.
So do you think that that point that lies well off the line, is that possibly a significant effect that due to some resonance in your system or something, or is it just noise?
So we first have to really do a careful error bar analysis. And if the error bar is smaller, then we have to worry about that point maybe. But can I come back to this at the end? Because, good. Right, so last thing what we need to do, pair creation process, it is on a straight line. It's a good question, you know, error bars are very important. We haven't done that part yet. Now, what is the surface gravity? There's a formula for the surface gravity, and that can actually be related just by looking at the background flow, by calculating the propagation speed, which is a function of the square root of h, and the background flow is 1 over h, so by having the depths everywhere, I can calculate the surface gravity, and I compare these two slopes, and we can say the surface gravity is roughly between 0.02 and 0.18 hertz. This thing here, because it's 1 over 8, is about 0.1 hertz. So these two things seem to match. So it seems this slope, there are two ways to measure this slope, and that's according to Hawking, either you measure the surface gravity or you measure the excitations. So this works out. So summarizing this first, I have, not first part, don't worry, it's, I only have another three slides. So the result is that, what did we learn from that? We see that the stimulated Hawking process, the pair creation is a pair creation with a thermal spectra, is confirmed in a white hole in an analog gravity system. The lesson is that, of course, this is a very robust process. It's a very robust phenomenon. And what we can see is it survives all the deviations in the fluid dynamics, such as viscosity, vorticity, and also all this modification at the dispersion relation. And that really ensures our trust in the black hole evaporation process. Now, all of you probably wonder, you know, Hawking process, that's quantum, but what you're doing is entirely classical. Now, the point is here, what we are looking at are stimulated waves. Stimulated waves, you know, we look at millimeters we're sending in, and everything above, that's what you stimulate. There's classical noise, which comes from the shaking of the flume, is about 10 to the minus 4 meter, right? It's a classical noise, and we can actually, and then when you go down in a hierarchy of scales, about 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 10 meters, you expect there's a thermal noise. And if you could go further down, then there would be the quantum noise at around amplitudes 10 to the minus 17. Of course, that is impossible to measure. So this will never be possible here. But what we can do, instead of look at a stimulated wave, we can look at the classical noise. And that should be possible because, as Bill pointed out, black holes work like linear amplifiers. You send more in, you get more out. What we sent it in was around here. Maybe we can repeat the procedure here. We will never go down here. But since it's a linear amplifier and it works well in those amplitudes, the more one should expect, they also work here. So the last part, the last two slides, okay. How can one extend that? Is that it? Can we only do quantum fields in curved space-time? Is there any hope to go beyond? Now, before I'm going to go beyond, I want to maybe say, can you have a conceptual transference, or are there some quantum gravity models where there's actually a resemblance between, you know, excitations in our analog gravity system and in a real gravity, quantum gravity system? Now, the first is, so there's this Horavolicious gravity, as you all know, where what you have is, I have to cut it very short, but you slice space-time in non-intersecting spatial slices, and what you see is basically you can then modify gravity by add extra terms to the action, to Einstein-Hilbert gravity, extra terms in a way that you only add effectively higher spatial derivatives. So what you do, you make this ADM family splitting physical, you introduce a global foliation, a rigid global foliation, and on these slices here, you introduce higher spatial three curvature terms. So what you do, you break has an anisotropy between space and time. You only add higher spatial derivatives. And what you can do effectively, you can see that in this procedure, from a naive power counting arguments, you can make the gravitational coupling constant dimensionless. So the hope is that such a theory will be renormalizable. Now, important is for what I think, what I'm interested in, if you look at these excitations in the systems, first, of course, because you have a global foliation here, you free the spin zero mode. So the spin zero, the spin two gravitational fluctuations, and all the quantum field theory in such a theory, if you would look at matter fields and so on, they encounter dispersion relations, which are of the form as encountered in many of these analog gravity systems, which means it's nonlinear Bogle-Yugov or Roton-like dispersion relations. Now, two more slides. What is interesting, actually, is that in such a system, that Horava-Lifshitz gravity got some two very nice connection to existing quantum gravity theories. One of them is causal dynamical triangulation, and the other one is Einstein-Ether. So I think Ted will talk about Einstein-Ether, and what could be shown is actually Ted wrote the first paper on it. He showed that Horava-Lifshitz gravity in the infrared limit reduces to a particular form of Einstein-Ether. I'm not saying much about it. I guess Ted will talk about it. And what also there has been a connection initially pointed out by Petri Horava, he said in causal dynamical triangulation, which is actually a discrete quantum gravity theory, where you would take the path integral, you take a discrete version of Einstein-Hilbert, a Ricci calculus with a fixed edge length, and you would have all the different, all the possible discrete triangulations of space-time geometry, which is your configuration space, and then you would weigh it with Einstein, the discrete version of Einstein-Hilbert, and when you do this averaging process, there is a smooth geometry emergent. And roughly speaking, at long scales, they found out that this isn't very good correspondence to general relativity. Now, at short scales, there was a deviation from that, and they had a particular probe, which is by evaluating a diffusion process in this structure and calculating the return probability. And what they found is in this probe that there are strong deviations from GR. What Petri Horava pointed out is that actually the limits of this probe are the same in CDT as they are in Horava-Lifshitz gravity. So recently we did some data analysis together with Matt Wiss and Thomas Sotirio on this data set, and we could show that not only the endpoints are the same, it seems that the whole flow of this probe coincides with Horava-Lifshitz gravity in 2+1 dimensions. Now, the question is now, how can you get a step further? Could you ever find a tabletop experiment to use something like causal dynamical triangulation and simulate it with a real physical system? So the answer, and that's a work in progress, is what is the first thing you would need to do? Well, I find it very unsatisfying to have at the fundamental level something like a building block. And, you know, building blocks appear and disappear. So the first thing one would need to do, one need to take these building blocks and replace this notion of building blocks with a real system. So in 1+1 CDT, it seems to be possible to find a new fundamental building block, what we call the fork, and this is an independent variable, so meaning you can have zeros or ones, they're independent, and each one of these configurations, so a bit array, corresponds, can be mapped onto a triangulation. Similarly, with this formalism, every arbitrary triangulation can be mapped on a bit array. Now, there is also a correspondence, once you have this structure, you can easily promote it to a qubit, an n qubit. And what you can then do by, instead of here in CDT, they would have to do this averaging process with the Einstein-Hilbert action. What you can do here, there are so-called mapping methods where you can map quantum states on statistical partition function for statistical methods, systems. And what you can do actually, you can calculate with these states, you can calculate quantum amplitudes and map onto the partition function of CDT. So finishing, what have we learned, or what is the outcome? So different systems share some phenomenological aspects, and that's not very surprising. Analog gravity systems, they hide the true degrees of freedom to some extent. And at the regime of validity, the full dynamical equations only determine the background configuration. So they work if you don't take the dynamics into account, if you're in the linear regime. So, of course, they only hide the degrees of freedom to some extent because, as Ted pointed out, that this modification and dispersion relation, that they're not linear, these are already indication that there is a substructure. And so, and these, they're different enough, and that's actually very good. It's precisely the point that these analog gravity systems are not the same, because they are different at short scales, and they are vastly different. So, but this also allows you whatever effect you're looking for. If it doesn't depend on the micro, on these deviations, then it means it's independent of that, and that actually teaches you something about this effect, that it's a very robust and general effect. Last but not least, this analog gravity system, they offer a link between real-life system and semi-classical quantum gravity, and as such, offer the possibility to tabletop experiments. So maybe at the end, so Bill had this original paper, he said experimental black hole evaporation, maybe, and maybe, you know, by having, if you find a real system that behaves just like, for example, CDT, this would also offer the possibility, the opportunity to have experimental quantum gravity systems. So to finish, I really don't know much about the concept of, the general concept of emergent or effective field theories, and why they work, but I really trust in analogies, and I think not believing in analogies is almost as not believing in physics. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a couple of questions, possibly from Bill if there are absolutely no others. But then we'll
just
move
to a... Just a quick comment
a,
before Nigel runs away. Well, it's about 10 to the third.
That's the Reynolds number you're talking
about? Yes.
Okay. Okay, so we'll just take a couple of more questions, but then additional ones can be asked during the discussion when all of the people will be involved. Let me take Chris and then Philip.
So just a very general question. This is a very cool work, but I was wondering if there's a kind of downside of discovering that there's a robust sort of universal phenomena associated with Hawking radiation, namely that you might be able to discover less about a particular underlying theory because it's so universal, right? So that if you were trying to discover specific features of quantum field theory on curved spacetimes or of quantum gravity, does the discovery that it's universal or possibly universal actually mean it's going to be harder to discover things about the particular system you're interested in because of that that feature?
I don't know if you talk about analog gravity system, you mean in real, you know, in real quantum gravity. Well, the problem is that in real quantum gravity, we don't know what the theory is. We don't know what is, if I'm having, I'm taking quantum field theory in curved space-time, how would real quantum gravity change at small scales? How would it enter in this equation? So we don't know. So if you want to make any predictions for that, you would have to do a lot of model building and say, you know, it depends very much on this. And each one, how you modify, extend the effective field theory, you would get a different outcome. So in this sense, somehow, it is very arbitrary. But if it turns out that whatever you add to the theory will not alter the effect, you can be sure that's there. You know, or you can ensure your trust that this effect does not depend on that. So you say, I can actually use quantum fields in curved space times to derive this effect. And so, yes, you maybe, you know, you cannot use Hawking radiation if you're ever able to detect it to get some insight, more insight into your full quantum gravity theory. On the other hand, maybe it's at one step very, very comforting to know that the black hole evaporation process seems to be very robust.
So I'd like to come back to the turbulence. So Bill has just computed the Reynolds number to be approximately 1,000. Which I guess would slightly worry me. So you said you were going to tell us how you assured that there was no turbulence. So how
actually,
did you do it?
I am very sorry because I noticed when I was going through the talk that I had to cut out some slides. So what we did is very simple. If I get a piece of chalk. So I don't know, can you see it here? So we have our obstacle in the water, right? And then what we would put in, we put in cleolite particles, this with the same buoyancy than water, we put them in, and when they basically they flow with, they go with the flow, right? And then you take pictures of that, where you would have your shutter time open long enough So that basically these particles seems like little streaks because it's moving in the time. Now what we can do, we can map this out here and we can see what's happened. If you would have turbulences, for example, then you would see that the particles start to go like this. But what we made sure and how we designed the obstacle is that we don't have any of this, that we always have a nice lamina flow behavior. Now, of course, if you look at the velocity profile as a function of height, you know, we usually go out from a uniform velocity, which is, of course, which is actually seems to be here a very good approximation. But when you come down the obstacle, because of viscosity and the non-slip boundary condition, basically, this does it's not uniform completely, so you get this the velocity profile looks more like that. So to answer your question, we behaved like, you know, real experimentalists, and we said, we don't know, so very worrisome, right? All these things should be in a system. So what we did, we can look at that, and we can optimize it as much as possible, hoping at the end it wouldn't matter. And in fact, given the result, one could argue, might not have been a bad approximation.
That's what I would have said, except it's not at all clear to me what the effect of microturbulence would be on this experiment. I mean, whether the deviations would be large.
But this is a bit of a weird, given that all the
I understand what you're saying. You're saying that, you know, theory agrees with experiment, therefore, even if there is turbulence there, it's not having an effect.
Right.
But it would, I mean, it's a good question to know what the effect would be. I mean, after all, microturbulence is, you know, also giving small contributions.
Can I actually give you, so if you say that, then you have to ask, who can see this turbulence? The wavelengths we're sending in are between 67 meters to 2 meters. These are the scales. So now you say, are these scales probing these microturbulences? You know, this is another thing, and I would argue we're sending in long, long wavelengths. So, and in these scales, microturbulences seem to be unimportant.
In the gravitational analogy is like saying that very high frequency stuff that's in the Hawking calculation has no effect on the long wavelength physics.
No, but even the outgoing radiation, which we're in here, have wavelengths of 20, 30 centimeters. So that, turbulence on size scales of 1 centimeter just aren't going to have any effect.
Because it's short wavelength stuff riding on long wavelength stuff, and your argument is that mode-mode coupling is weak.
Right.
Then the answer to the question of why high frequency stuff in Hawking's calculation is irrelevant for the low frequency stuff?
No.
Do you agree with that, Ted?
Why don't we, this would be a good type of question to continue more for general discussion. So why don't we thank Silke for her talk.